Good morning, Your Honor. I'm here to present a young man's claim of persecution and torture that he has pursued since he first came to the United States in 1997, yet has never been able to have adjudicated, even under the Convention Against Torture. The Board has abused its discretion in both of its decisions issued in petitioner's case, where it inexplicably departed from established policies and is made without rational explanation. The claim that's never been heard is that of a young ethnic Kachin Burmese minority involved in the democracy movement in his country, seeking an end to the military regimes that have ruled Burma since 1962 and which killed his brother, left his father permanently disabled from forced labor and torture, and finally, that detained, interrogated, and physically abused petitioner himself, for which he finally fled as a student activist involved in the pro-democracy movement there. I have 4 points to make today. The first petition involves circumstances necessary for rescission of an in absentia order. Second, the regulatory deadline to seek CAT relief was inappropriately applied to this petitioner. Regarding the second petition, the two other points would be that the board did not apply a prima facie standard to this motion to reopen, which it should have. And fourthly, that the board denied CAT relief without reasoned explanation or consideration of the facts. And it does call into serious question this country's commitment to relief under the Convention Against Torture. On the first decision of the board, petitioner did not appear at his hearing. However, he was suffering under post-traumatic stress disorder, which has been diagnosed and submitted into the record, and for which he was found that it seriously impaired his ability to appropriately proceed on his claims that he filed affirmatively from within a month and a half of his entry into the United States. Further, he was without assistance of counsel. He did not speak English. He appeared at the first hearing. The immigration judge did not, and for that reason it was continued. He submitted change of address forms of his address in California and did attempt to comply to his understanding of what was required of him. And he did file a very detailed asylum application prior to ever being put into court proceedings. Given the post-traumatic stress disorder, that should come under the finding, the requirement of a serious illness of the applicant as a basis for reopening an in absentia order. And it should have been remanded for consideration of the asylum and withholding claims. Secondly, on that first petition, the board applied a statutory deadline for filing under the Convention Against Torture, the deadline of June 21, 1999. My understanding is that is inappropriately applied, because what happened is he had an in absentia order, and the only means to apply to appeal an in absentia order is a motion to rescind that order with the same immigration judge. When the judge then makes a decision on that, you appeal to the Board of Immigration Appeals. You cannot go directly to the board from the in absentia order itself. So that he appealed the decision of the judge, and it was on appeal, not a final order of deportation, so he should not have been held to that regulatory deadline of June 99 to get his application in under the Torture Convention. It should have been remanded with no statutory deadline, and that was a legal error on the part of the board in the first petition. The second petition, the board made a decision that they applied a prima facie standard, a motion to reopen, but in fact they don't. And each of the cases they cite in that decision are not regarding motions to reopen. They're regarding applications under the Torture Convention of a more likely than not standard, not reasonable likelihood for a motion to reopen. Under the board's precedent decisions in matter of LOG and In re SV, that's the board's precedent on motion to reopen that says it must be a prima facie, meaning reasonable likelihood of statutory eligibility. In fact, the board itself had said evidence reveals a reasonable likelihood that the statutory requirements for relief have been satisfied. The board does not require a conclusive showing of eligibility for relief to permit a motion to reopen, which is what petitioner asked for. This standard was recognized by the Seventh Circuit Court in Mansour versus Ashcroft in 2000 regarding a motion to reopen for CAT relief. Secondly, that same decision has not said what facts or what country reports it did rely upon. It does not provide a rational explanation that this gives this court something to review. It makes a very conclusory statement that the evidence contained in the record does not merit the petitioner's claim, and it's extremely conclusory. It gives you no basis on which what facts they're looking at, either in the I-589 asylum application or contained in the country report. We don't know what they're looking at. And in Mansour, again, the Seventh Circuit Court did remand a motion to reopen under CAT, where the board, in quote, a minimalistic, non-detailed manner, addressed the torture claim. The Seventh Circuit said that a motion to reopen requires the board consider the issues raised, announce its decision in terms sufficient to enable the reviewing court to perceive it as heard and thought and not merely reacted. It found that without a reasonable justification, the board abused its discretion. We have that same scenario once again here. Very recently, in Menzitsu, the Seventh Circuit Court in an Ethiopian case on January 22nd of this year reversed a denial of motion to reopen, finding that the board failed to build a rational bridge between events and claims for its legal conclusion. In Chile Pirar, the court remanded a torture convention claim to have a consideration of the State Department's most current report. That was also submitted to this court in petitioner's case and was accepted by the court into the record. The board in petitioner's case does not indicate what it's reviewed. It merely concludes, although the country condition material in the record confirms some instances of brutality by the military, petitioner doesn't meet his claim. What have they looked at? I don't know. They've looked at some material in current country reports. They've not looked at a asylum declaration that gave extremely detailed information regarding persecution that he'd already suffered in Burma. There's no mention of that. There's no mention of the supporting documents that were submitted with the asylum application and gave extensive news reports of repression against student activists, against the Kachin minority movement. I don't know if the board looked at it or not. We don't know. Petitioner, in fact, was not only politically active against the Burmese government, which is notorious for flagrant human rights abuses and torture of its opponents, but he was also arrested for his political activities, and that demonstrates the requisite prima facie reasonable likelihood eligibility required for a motion to reopen, since it sets forth reasons why the Burmese government would target him, coupled with country condition reports contained in the record. The facts alleged, the facts in the record, including the asylum application, together with news reports, the State Department report of 1999, which was submitted with his motion to reopen under the torture convention, together with the psychological assessment that was submitted with the second motion to reopen, and the 2002 State Department report that's now been submitted into the record. The Seventh Circuit Court in Mild Wynn, 1998, involved an asylum claim of a Burmese parent of a student activist. And in that decision, the board recognized the repressive military regimes in Burma since 1962, which carried out brutal crackdowns on protesters, students, supporters of democracy, and I'm taking this directly from that case. They recognized that it left hundreds of persons dead. It was remanded under a social group theory of parents of detained student protesters for the asylum claim. The board leaves no reasoned explanation for this court's review. At a minimum, it should be remanded under the Convention Against Torture, although it's urged that the court also remand for consideration under our asylum laws. This man has been attempting to get his claim of torture, persecution, before a court to have it adjudicated on the merits. The board appears to have attempted to do that in a motion to reopen, but does not let us know what it's basing its decision on. Motion to reopen should be reasonable likelihood of statutory eligibility, not more likely than not standard once it's reopened. Thank you. I'll reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson. Now from Ms. Foxter.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, my name is Aviva Foxer for the respondent. The two petitions for review which were consolidated by the Court in this case should be dismissed, Your Honors, because first, the Board did not abuse its discretion in denying petitioner's appeal from the immigration judge's denial of his motion to reopen his in absentia hearing. And second, the Board didn't abuse its discretion in denying petitioner's motion to reopen where he failed to make out a prima facie showing of eligibility for Convention Against Torture or CAT protection. This case, Your Honors, basically involves an alien who failed to appear for his immigration court hearing, although he acknowledges that he had notice of the time and location of the proceeding. This Court should defer to the conclusion of the Board that petitioner did not present evidence of exceptional circumstances as required by the statute.
IJs can transfer a case from one venue to another, can't they?
Yes, they can, but generally that's done upon a petitioner's or alien's motion for a change of venue.
But the IJ must have known that this fellow had moved out of the Chicago area, was now out in San Francisco, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that was evident. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that in every case that an alien would want their case transferred simply because they have relocated.
Is there any custom or practice with cases like this? The guy who show up say tough, or do you is some effort made to ascertain whether or not the change of address was meant to also indicate or an expectation the matter would be taken up out of San Francisco?
Well, in this case in particular, Your Honor, the petitioner was given actually an extra opportunity to appear in Chicago after he filed his change of address form. The Court then rescheduled to provide him an opportunity to make sure that he would appear. Most immigration courts have local operating procedures which indicate that in order for a change of venue to be granted, it has to be an affirmative motion made by either party. And in this case, such a motion was not made. Change of address forms are not construed to be requests for change of venue. Under these types of circumstances, the alien who has the burden of proof of making their case has to inform the court of their intentions in terms of actually coming to a hearing.
The scheduling notice sent in what language?
In English, Your Honor. And in fact, this court has held that those notices are sufficient in Nazarova v. INS as long as the hearing notice would provide the alien with an understanding that further inquiry is required. And in fact, in this case, since the alien appeared for his initial hearing, it's presumed that he understood that notice was requiring him to show up to Chicago for a hearing. Furthermore, in terms of petitioner's claims regarding his asylum, that's really not before the court at this point, because he's got to get his case reopened based on exceptional circumstances in order for him to get yet another adjudication on the asylum. And when I say yet another adjudication, what I mean is that petitioner concedes that he had an initial adjudication before an asylum officer of the asylum claim. INS, or the former INS, has in fact already taken the first level of adjudication in this case. He was referred to the immigration judge following an asylum officer's determination that he did not make out a case for asylum. In addition, the board has already looked at this case on two separate occasions. So this isn't a case in which the petitioner was denied any sort of process. The only thing that he hasn't had right now is an immigration court hearing. His case has, however, been reviewed. And furthermore, any of his allegations regarding his participation in the student movement, persecution of his family, etc., have not been tested for their credibility because he didn't come to his hearing where that testing would have taken place. In terms of the expert's post-traumatic stress disorder report, I note that that report was only filed with his last motion to reopen before the board. The credibility of that report has also not been tested.
The board doesn't really get into it, though, does it? It decides he doesn't have a good case under the CAT, but it doesn't mention that report.
No, it doesn't. It does not mention that report. However, the board is presumed to look through the entire record when such a case is decided. And this
pretty prominent part of the record.
Well, it is part of the record, yes, Your Honor.
Pretty prominent part.
If the court thinks so, yes. The government certainly has certain questions about the record, about that report. For example, the fact that this diagnosis was made after 1 2-hour interview.
Oh, that's stuff that, you know, trier of fact's going to worry about. I mean, the fact of the matter is, what's in the record? This is a pretty big part of what the man's offered, right?
Yes, it is. It is, and in fact, that's a good point, Your Honor. That's the only thing that he offered with his motion to reopen. Although, pursuant to the statute and regulations, he's required to make out a prima facie case based on the documents submitted with that motion alone. So, in fact, if that requirement...
When did the country report get in the record?
The country report got into the record when petitioner tried to file it as an attachment to the reply brief in this case, the most recent country report. This court took judicial notice, rather, of that report at that time.
So the country report was not before the immigration authorities?
An earlier report was before the immigration authorities, yes. It was in the record.
Was that substantially different from this one?
No. I would submit that actually certain small portions of this report, although the government does not necessarily defend the actions of the government of Burma, certain parts of the new report do indicate some improvement in Burmese country conditions, some minor improvement, but they are substantially the same report.
If you take that country report and the expert's report, what do you think this guy's life expectancy is in Burma?
Well, Your Honor, again, because he didn't come to his hearing, we don't know anything about his credibility. We don't know that anything that he says is true in this case. And again, the government does have questions concerning that report.
I'm worried about the dismissal of the CAT petition. It seems to me that there's a pretty good, if we could consider the country report on the CAT, there's a pretty good case here. This guy's got a long road to hoe.
Well, again, Your Honor, that would have to be assuming that he's credible and assuming that everything he said is true.
Is that country report, was that before the immigration authorities when they decided the CAT petition had no merit?
Yes, Your Honor. It was in the record. The board did have the country conditions before it at that time.
I'm looking at the order, which is relatively short, I suppose. What was the basis that the board did not reopen?
If we're talking about the
March
torture convention,
2003 order.
The board focused on country conditions in Burma, which again included a country report. And again, petitioner did not distinguish himself, or the board didn't find his case to be distinguished from.
I think the language was respondent falls short of making a prima facie showing.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there's no need to explain why he fell short.
Well, again, even pursuant to this court's case law, the board is not required to make an exegesis on every contention. I mean, obviously, the board considered the country conditions in the record.
Not even one contention?
In this case, the board made clear that it was considering country conditions evidence in the record.
Yeah, but there's no explanation beyond that. It's just given such short shrift. I mean, that's what troubles me about it. I mean, this was the heart of his complaint, and there was I agree that courts haven't required for each little finding that they make or each conclusion they make that the rationale for it is there, but this was the major thrust of his claim.
That is correct, Your Honor. However, again, he had the opportunity to make out a very strong case for Convention Against Torture protection, and he failed to do so. I mean, the fact that the board issues a sentence rather than 10 sentences or 20 doesn't really obviate the fact that his claim was not strong. He didn't make out the type of claim. He had the opportunity to make out a claim in which the board would have said, oh, yeah, absolutely, no question about it. He gets this protection, and he failed to do so. Again, it's his burden, regardless of the number of sentences written in the board's
Aren't
decision.
Aren't we supposed to look at this for an abuse of discretion, where the board abused their discretion in denying this reopening?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And again, that standard is rather high for a petitioner to show to this court. This court generally does defer to these types of decisions because of the high standard in this case.
But then in order for us to determine if it's an abuse, don't you think explanations help?
Yes, they certainly do help, Your Honor.
Which are not here.
Well, the government's position is that it's sufficient here in this case. If there's nothing further, my time's up.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Patterson, you have 1 minute.
Regarding the change of venue that the judge could have ordered, the judge is under a statutory and regulatory duty to develop apparent eligibility for immigration relief. He had a detailed asylum application, he had no attorney, and he had a respondent trying to comply, submitting changes of addresses, showing up for the first hearing. He could well have changed the venue on it. That would have been an appropriate time and place to do it. Sufficient for rescission? Yes. He hired an attorney immediately upon getting an in absentia order. He's pursued every avenue since he got that in absentia order and understood the ramifications of that and what had happened. That he's had an attorney. Within a month of that, he filed a motion to rescind the in absentia order. He filed an appeal of that decision of the judge. He then submitted a motion to remand under the torture convention, and he's pursued every avenue available to him. This is a man intent on presenting his claim and getting a hearing. The torture convention, I think, the country signing of that torture convention, at a minimum, requires some adjudication of these claims, where we have very strong State Department reports condemning the Burmese military regime and recognizing the severe human rights abuses.
Your time has expired.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry, please.
Ms. Patterson, your name's not on the brief, I assume. Are you part of the firm that
it should be on, if not the first one, the rest of them. I am part of the firm of Rotoro Domingo.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Our thanks to both counsel. This case will be submitted.